I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I realized the importance of self-care. Whether that's a 5 kilometer run, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5 minute dip in the sea, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. This season, I've teamed up with Spotlight Oral Care. I know how important oral health is to our overall health and how we really need to look after our teeth and gums by using the best products. I've been using the Spotlight Oral Care Water Flosser. It removes bacteria from deep between the teeth and below the gum line, where traditional brushing and flossing cannot reach, while stimulating gums to improve circulation. Paired with my Sonic toothbrush, I love that it gives me a professional feel clean at home. Use discount code GOODGLOW25 at spotlightoralcare.com to get 25% off the entire range. This week on the Good Glow podcast, I speak to Jodie Wood. She has a beautiful birth story after her first baby boy, Milo, arrived into the world when she was 33 weeks pregnant. Her husband, Will, was away in France on a charity walk at the time, and Jodie started to get some pains. She thought they would pass, but she soon realised that she was in labour and rushed to the hospital with her mum by her side. This is a gorgeous story about family and love and support, and I really hope you enjoy it. Next week on the podcast, it will be my last episode of this season. I cannot believe how fast this season has gone by, and I've gotten so much from it and absolutely loved every single episode. So thank you so much for tuning in. Next week, I will be announcing something very exciting. So please do tune in if you can. And I hope you enjoyed this podcast today. So over to Jodie. Jodie, I am so excited to talk to you on my podcast today. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
I'm even more excited to be talking to you. And I feel so privileged to even have been asked to sit down and have a chat.
I absolutely love following you. And actually, something that may be of interest to people is that our husbands have actually become friends over the last while. So we'll get into all of that later in the podcast.
Your and romance.
Yes. Luckily, they're within each other's 5K. So they've been going on hikes, and we'll get into all of that later. But I wanted to first congratulate you. You've got a new baby, Noah. He's an absolute dote. How are you feeling?
He is so cute. I love him so much. He's great. He's 6 months now. It's gone so fast, like much faster on baby number two. It just flies, but he's good. We're doing really well. It's just the chaos of adapting to two kids, I think, is wild for every parent, I suppose, but we're getting there.
That's so good. And we were chatting a couple of months ago, just I love to do a birth story on the Good Glow once per season. So I wanted to talk to you all about your birth story with Milo, because it's unique. There's a lot of different things that went on around that time in your life. Of course, you're married to the gorgeous Will, and you decided that it was time to have a baby, but you had been diagnosed with something a couple of years previously, so you, I suppose, had to take extra precaution in your pregnancy, did you?
Exactly. So about 2 years before, it was actually the year we were getting married, so it was nearly five years ago now, we obviously had a lot going on that year, and I started to basically just feel generally really unwell. I was getting episodes of like repeat vertigo. I kept getting what I thought was like a vomiting bug or a stomach ulcer. I was nauseous permanently. I was getting headaches, a little bit of blurred vision, just generally unwell. And it was kind of coming in waves. And I remember like it got to the stage where it was so debilitating, like I missed my granny's funeral. And then it was my hen like a month after that. And the second day of my hen, I was just completely bedbound. I missed the night out. I just was so unwell. And I remember after that being like, something's not right. This can't just be like a vomiting bug that's not going away. So I went to my GP, who's amazing. And I'd been to her kind of a little bit in the run up to that. And she had just been saying, okay, it's probably like X, Y, and Z. But I went to her eventually, and I was like, I can't keep living like this. Something is not right. So she referred me to an ENT consultant in the Beacon as well. And I went and saw him, and he actually diagnosed me with Meniere's disease, which is like basically a kind of inner ear problem, and it's what can give you vertigo and balance issues and X, Y, Z. And I kind of left there and I was like, I don't think that it is it. You know, when you just get like an itch and you want to believe them, but I was like, I just don't feel like that's it. And when I went away and researched it, I was sort of like, some of the boxes were ticked, but some of them, it just wasn't quite right. So anyway, he was like, I'm going to send you for a routine MRI as part of like just checking out everything's fine in your ear or brain or whatever. So I went back for my results 2 weeks later, and I went in, and I remember like he had to leave the room for a minute, but I could see on his screen there was like a letter kind of detailing what was going on. And I was reading it sort of half waiting for him to come back in the room, reading what the letter said. And I was like, oh God, there's something else. So he came back in, he was like, look, in the MRI, they found that you actually have a brain condition that you've probably had since birth, but it normally only presents in like later years of either childhood or early adulthood. I was 25 then. So he was like, it could just be completely coincidental that we found it now, or it could be what's been causing the symptoms. So he referred me to a neurologist. So I went to my neurologist in the weekend, and he basically explained that I either was born with it or developed it in childhood. And it's a brain condition called Chiari malformation. And what that is means the base of your skull, in my case, basically stopped growing too early in childhood, or else it was just too small to house my giant brain, you know, just the genius that I am. But what it is it puts pressure on the very base of your brain at the top of your spine, and that can cause an increase in pressure in the brain, and that can give you all of the symptoms that I was experiencing. So that was when I finally got diagnosed with that. And as part of that, when I first met my neurologist, I was like asking, you know, what impact will it have on life? And one of the things he said was when I was going to give birth, that it just would be safer to deliver by cesarean section rather than natural birth because of the pressure with the pushing and labor and that kind of thing. So I was secretly delighted. I always was terrified of giving birth. So I was like, oh no, a C-section, sign me up. But yeah, that's where that came from.
Were you scared when he told you that this is what was wrong with you, or were you relieved? Did you kind of think maybe it could have been something worse? And when he told you what it was, you were very reassured?
I was scared when the ENT told me, because I was on my own for the appointment, because I thought it was just like that he was telling me more about the inner ear problem, or that there was nothing in the MRI kind of thing. So when I left that, I was, I think, a bit more shell-shocked that there was something more sinister, I guess, or underlying. And at that stage, I had been so unwell for so long that in my head, I was worrying that it was going to get worse rather than, okay, now we know what it is, so it can be managed, or, you know, that there was an outcome. But I do think a lot of that was stress related that year, between we had like house moves, weddings, lots of friends getting married, deaths in the family. And it was, I think, like a combination of the stress in to also, I suppose, mix with the condition. And that's why I was feeling so generally unwell. So I just made a lot of lifestyle changes that year, and that helped massively in managing it. Now, like since then, now that I am aware of how to look after myself and kind of keep the symptoms at bay, I don't have flare-ups as bad anymore.
It's certainly one of those things in your 20s when you're juggling everything and you're trying to be really successful and you're, you know, trying to work on a relationship and you've got mm-hmm. all of these things going on, and the stress just keeps building and building. And when I'm out talking to people, young people, I can see that, you know, that is still going on to this yeah. day. Some days I still feel like my body is trying to heal from the 12 years of stress that
I'm sure.
I feel like I was under. So stress is such a scary thing, and it can bring up so much. But I think when people yeah. understand stress, they can address it. It's really important to get to know when you are feeling stressed and what you can do about it.
I totally
agree. So you
said
there that you made certain lifestyle changes. What were they?
So like things like I never was a big drinker, to be honest, before. Like I never was one to like go out on a mad night out because I would always be so sick. Like even if I have three drinks, I'm vomiting the next day. Like I just can't drink. But like reducing alcohol even more. So now I'll just have like one glass of wine here and there and that's fine. Reducing salt intake, making sure I sleep. So sleep is a massive one that affects it for the vertigo. And obviously now I don't get any sleep because my child is a nutbag and likes to have the chats at 3 a.m. So things like just trying to rest and give yourself a little bit of breathing space, I suppose. In my 20s, I was go, 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 and doing everything and all over the place and traveling nonstop. And I just moved to basically a slower pace of life, and that helped massively.
And you met Will, and did you ever kind of contemplate that you might set up your life in England, or was it always going to be Ireland?
So when I first met Will, I think like it was like our second or third, I knew I was going to get married to Will after the first time he ever came over here. I was like, this is my husband, this is it. So I was like, you need to lay down the law pretty early on here and drop it into the conversation that, you know, we won't be living in England. So I was like, you know, I'd love to live in London for a while. So I ended up doing my master's over there. And then we had always talked about how we would eventually settle in Ireland. And I'm so lucky. I mean, he absolutely loved it here, even from just coming over when we first started dating and visiting. He loves, you know, that you've the sea 10 minutes away, the mountains 10 minutes away, the city centre within half an hour. You know, you have everything on your doorstep here. Whereas in London, you know, it's so vast. Like all of our friends are in London, but they might live 40 minutes or an hour away, and that's considered local in London. So he just loves it here, luckily, and he was happy to settle. But I always wanted to be near my family and friends when I had kids and everything like that.
So the time came for you to have your first baby, and mm-hmm. you knew that you had this underlying condition. And did that play on your mind during your pregnancy? Because I have a friend who has an underlying condition and she's going now to have her second baby. And it's a little bit kind of in the back of her mind all the time that it may not be as straightforward at the end that as she would like. So was this kind of playing on your mind?
So to be honest, when I first got pregnant with Milo, I was, I guess, naive in a way. I didn't really, like, it never came into my head that I could have a premature baby, never once. But I was more concerned about whether my symptoms would start to flare up again during pregnancy, like whether the vertigo would come back badly and that kind of thing. And you can't take the medication that I'm prescribed during pregnancy, so that was my main worry. But I have the most amazing gynecologist. I love him so much, and his name's Sam Coulter Smith. If anyone is ever looking for a recommendation for a baby, go to him in the Rotunda. But he put me at ease from the beginning, and he was like, no, you know, we'll scan you routinely and extra scans if you need and keep an eye on everything, but you know, really the only difference will be the delivery, hopefully. So towards kind of the middle of the pregnancy, I went and met the anesthetics team and the anesthetist that would be doing my section, and we kind of discussed the different options for whether, you know, we would do an epidural or a spinal block and what would work best for the brain and worst case scenario and that kind of thing. So, you know, then you're probably used to hearing all of that kind of stuff in appointments. Then I was a bit like, oh, okay, something, you know, it's probably a 1 in a million chance, but then the seed is planted in your mind that something could go horribly wrong. So, you know, then you leave the hospital and I'm like to Will, you know, if something happens, you just promise me, like, you'll stay with the baby in Ireland, you won't take the baby, like, away, and my mum will get to see the baby and my dad and blah, blah. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, you're going to be absolutely fine. And of course I was, but your mind just goes to crazy places, I guess.
So the time came then for your gorgeous Milo to make his appearance into the world, but he was a little bit early.
Yes, he was a little bit early. So Will had been planning to go and do this trek in the French Alps with Restart Rugby, which is a charity he's really passionate about. And it was when I was 32 weeks pregnant, and it had kind of been an ongoing joke, you know, if he was away and I used to go into labor, but never in a million years did I think that would actually happen. So the week before he went, I had started to get really bad pelvic girdle pain, or what I thought was pelvic girdle pain, when in actual fact I think it was early labor now. But this was going on for about a week, and then the day came for him to go, and he was only, it was only a 3-day trip, I think. So I was like, look, just go, it'll be absolutely fine. But at this stage, I've signed off work because the pain was really bad. I couldn't really walk, and I don't know what, it was just bad. So I went in for my scan with my consultant on the Tuesday, and I was saying to him, look, Sam, it's really bad now. Like, I need some kind of pain relief, or like, I can't go to work. I can't. At that stage, I was working in a clinic, so I was sitting, you know, in my office all day long, and it just was not doable anymore. So he was like, okay, your waters are still intact. There's no sign of anything happening. I'm just going to refer you for physio. And if it gets really bad, you can come back in and we can start giving you some kind of injection, obviously for the pain. I can't remember exactly what. So that was it. So I went home Tuesday night. I spent the whole night like in and out of the bath. I was getting into the bath like every hour during the night, because that was the only way it would get rid of the pain, like having the water like scalding on my back. So I remember just being like, oh my God, I can't wait for Will to get back. And, you know, he can make my hot water bottles then. I won't have to do it and blah, blah, blah. So the next day it got worse and worse and worse. And I rang my mom, and she was in work that morning. And I was like, can you just come over? Like, I just am in so much pain. And she eventually came over like early lunchtime and came in, and she just took one look at me and she was like, we're going to the hospital, like something is not right. And I was like, okay, in my mind, I was like, yeah, you're right. Like, I need these injections. I need the pain relief. So she put me into the car. And at that stage, I don't know if it was like my body almost was like, okay, you're with someone now, so now you can take it to the next level. I don't know what it was, but I got into the car and my contractions started like really quickly, much closer together, whereas I hadn't had any contractions like, reach, like, you know, the way they start to come, like 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 2 minutes. I wasn't getting anything like that. I was just getting dull aches here and there, but no timed contractions until I got into the car. And then it was like every 5 minutes they were coming. And I was like, these must be contractions, because with your first baby, you don't know what anything feels like or what to expect. So we were like bombing it up the dual carriageway into town, and we got there and she threw me out of the car at the entrance to the rotunda. I was like, Mum, I'll run into A&E. So I went into A&E and Sam was there, and my mum went to park the car, which is a nightmare around the rotunda. Like, you could be looking for half an hour. So I went into A&E, got hooked up to the checks or whatever, and he did a check on me. And I remember him just kind of standing up next to me, and he took my hand and he was like, so the baby's coming now. And I was like, no. And I had a complete meltdown. I was like, no, no, no. Like, Will's not here. And I don't know if you had pregnancy tracker apps when you were pregnant with Pia, but you know the way you get an update at every week about like how the baby is. I remember I had read, because it was just 33 weeks that day, I had read like 90% of babies born at 33 weeks will survive. So I was like to him, my app said like not all the babies will survive. And he was like looking at me like I had lost the plot. But he was like, Jody, I was born at 33 weeks and look at me. And he's like 6'5", big burly man. And I was like, oh, okay, it'll be fine. So I had a meltdown for a minute. And then I kind of was like, you know what, get it together. The baby's coming now. Like, you have to get in the zone mentally here. So my mum came back in and I was like, Mom, the baby's coming now. So we're going to go to theater right now. So I had been in the hospital for maybe under 10 minutes. And I was like, you know, getting all your jewelry stripped, getting the horrible drink that you have to have before your surgery, getting the jabs, like quick steroid injection for the lungs. And we were being wheeled up to theater because I was 7 centimeters dilated at that stage. And obviously they didn't want the baby to start like moving down the birth canal because I was having the section planned. So we went up, and on the way up to theater, my mom was like, Do you need to ring Will and tell him what's going on? Because I had been talking to him and saying, you know, I'm going into hospital now or blah, blah, blah. But I hadn't told him the baby's coming now. And at that stage, she was in the airport waiting for a flight home from France. So I didn't want him to also be like worrying on the plane for the next 2 hours about what had happened and not be able to have contact. So I really didn't know whether to tell him then that the baby was coming or let him land and here then. But I kind of was like, look, I better talk to him in case, you know, God forbid something happened. So
And he had gone on this trip. It was a charity trip.
Yeah.
And he had gone with his friends on a walk up the Alps, was it?
Yeah. So he went on his own. Basically, Will used to play professional rugby, was his job. And then he had a serious neck injury and retired. And a friend of his, Ed Jackson, had this tragic accident the year before that, and he had jumped into a swimming pool. Ed was another rugby player, and damaged his neck and had been paralyzed and had regained his strength and was now able to walk. So Will was like, I'm going on Ed's charity climb with him. So it was really important to him. So I wanted him to go. So yeah, he was gone for all of this, basically.
So you then had to make the decision as to whether you told him before he got on the plane or just let him get the flight.
Because he was literally boarding the plane as I was being wheeled to theatre. So I didn't want, you know, the way there's nothing worse on a plane when you've no reception, you don't know what's going on. I know, but I did tell him. I rang him and I just said, the baby's coming. So I think, what did I say? I was like, you know, when you get here, there'll be a baby and don't worry. And it was scary.
Oh, Jodie. So your mum is obviously beside you. She is your best friend. She has stepped in Will's place. And I know that you've got an incredibly close relationship with your mum. So that must have been very reassuring to you that you had her with you.
Yeah. And in a way, you know, it's amazing that my mum was there, like at the birth of her first grandchild and with me. And I remember when you go in for a C-section, your partner or whoever's with you, they wait outside for the start of it. And then when it gets to the bit where they're about to do the cut, they're brought in. And I remember seeing my mum coming into theatre, like fully gowned up and just thinking like, what in God's name? This is hilarious. Like, why is my mum here in full scrubs? What is going on? I was on a complete another planet at that stage. But yeah, so I think when I got into surgery, I have to say I had such a lovely experience. Like, I loved my delivery with Milo, even though it was like unexpected. I had a really calm experience. I really enjoyed my C-section on both babies. And I can't, like, the staff in the rotunda, all of them, they just make it such a like positive experience. It was really, really nice. It just was getting over the initial shock that it was happening then and there, I think.
So baby Milo came, and I presume you went into recovery. Did you get to see him when you were in recovery?
No. So what happened was he was delivered. I don't really remember it clearly. I don't know why. I remember he was delivered and they took him out, and I had not found out the gender. We had left it a surprise. And I remember them saying, it's a boy. And I was like, I knew it was going to be a boy. So I was like, yay, he's here or whatever. And they kind of showed me him and showed him to mum, and then he's whisked off really quickly. So to NICU. So I never really got to see him when he was born. And then I went to recovery for my section. Mum had to leave for a little while. And then at that stage, Will had nearly landed. So I then got moved to, there was no beds on any of the maternity wards because it had been, do you remember that year? There was like snow, crazy snow in January, February. Or it was like December. Basically, everyone got pregnant and was delivering their baby around the same time as me 9 months later, because people were obviously just at it like rabbits during the snow, nothing else to do. Loads of people got pregnant, and it was like the busiest month in the hospital that year. So there was no beds. So I was moved to a gynecology ward, but Will eventually got into the hospital. He, so funny. So he obviously landed off the plane. He said he'd been bawling, crying to the air hostess on the Aer Lingus flight, couldn't get his words out, being like, my wife is having a baby. I need to get off the plane quicker. So he said they were so nice. They like moved him to the top of the airplane, gave him a beer, got him off really quickly. So he landed in Dublin and got a taxi straight into town. But there was protests everywhere that day about the abortion referendum coming up. So he couldn't get his taxi anywhere near the rotunda. So he had to get out about a mile away and run like to the hospital. So I can only imagine him running like in his backpack traveler gear to the rotunda at 9 o'clock at night. But anyway, he got there and came in. And I still hadn't seen Milo at this stage, and he was born at 4. So we were both obviously desperate to get down to the NICU and see him. And I hadn't told Will the gender. I wanted him like,
you wanted to see his face.
It was really special. It was amazing.
So when you told Will Milo was a boy, were you standing in front of Milo or was it just the two of you?
So in their little incubators in NICU, they have like little cards that they have like their name and their date of birth. Obviously, he didn't have a name. He actually didn't have a name for about 3 days because we hadn't really thought that far ahead yet. We had like a list of ideas, but we hadn't decided on one. So just said like baby Wood, and it was a blue card. So he was like, that's a boy or whatever. And that was amazing. And we both got to hold him for the first time then. And that was really special. But it's also, you know, it's just not the start that you picture for your baby. Like the first time I'm really seeing my baby, he's in an incubator, like with wires and tubes everywhere. And that was kind of shocking and took a bit of adjusting. But I think that night we were both just in a daze. Like it hadn't really sunk in that the baby was here yet. So we only got to stay for a couple of minutes in NICU, and then I went back to my ward for the night, and then Will came back in the next day, and then the whole process of the days in NICU began. And I don't think we really had any idea of what that was going to be like for the month ahead.
I'll get back to that conversation in just a minute, but first I wanted to give you an update on Spotlight Oral Care. Spotlight Oral Care understands that as oral care is so personal, it can be difficult to know where to start. This is where their brand new online advisory service comes in. In 3 easy steps, you can chat with the Spotlight consultant who will listen, address, and guide you through your oral care queries, build a personalized plan just for you, and it's a completely free service. Check out spotlightoralcare.com for more. Because I remember you sharing that story around that time and just kind of following your journey. And I remember just you'd be in the car going in to see him every day. But first of all, what was it like leaving hospital without him and going home? Obviously, in some ways it's good to be able to recover, but also your heart is in the rotunda.
Yeah, it was really hard. So I eventually got moved to my own room on the third night. So the second night I was moved to a maternity ward, and at that stage I couldn't really walk yet after the section, so I couldn't be up and down to NICU as and when I wanted. So the third day I got moved to a room and I stayed for 3 more nights. So I left the hospital probably on day 6, and I had naively thought that he would be fine by then and he'd be coming home with me, but he obviously wasn't ready to. And we were really lucky, you know, he didn't have any massive complications. He didn't have huge breathing issues. He just was on an NG tube being fed. So obviously he couldn't come home until he was able to have the tube removed and feed for himself. And that took the guts of a month. So, I mean, I was going home. We would go into NICU every morning. First, we left the hospital, obviously, without him. That was pretty crap. And you're going home, and I was pumping, I was expressing milk for him. So I was, you know, still doing everything you're doing, like waking up every 3 hours in the night to pump, but you're not waking up to feed your baby. So it's just not the same. It's just not the start that you picture of having your first baby home with you. And we would go into the hospital at about 8:30 every morning. We would drive in and I would stay there for the day. And Will would come in kind of like early afternoon because there was no point in him taking his paternity leave then when we didn't have the baby. So he was still going to work. And luckily that was only 5 or 10 minutes from the hospital. So he would come over at about 4 every day, and then we would sit and we would just like do the feeds or like spend time as much as we could with him. But you aren't allowed to like have the baby out of the incubator a lot because they are cold. So really you're just sitting next to the incubator for, you know, kind of 10 or 12 hours a day. And it's really mentally tiring because you don't have an end point. Like no one can say to you, your baby's going to be ready to go home next week or in 2 weeks. So every day you're going in and you're like asking the nurses from the night shift before, like, how did he do? How did he feed? Was he able to take a bottle? Because it's like, you can't leave until they can take 4 consecutive feeds from a bottle with no NG tube, no help feeding. So it's like every day you're like, how many bottles? Just praying, like, oh, he had three in a row, so maybe he's nearly ready to have four in a row and then he'll get to come home. So it took him, I think about 3.5 weeks of that. And then he was able to feed and we were able to bring him home, which was amazing.
And how did you get through those days? Like, you know, I can't imagine how tiring it is to sit in a hospital all day long, but also you're so emotional after having a baby. How did you get through that time? Like, who did you have around you?
Yeah, so we basically moved into my parents' house. They really like looked after us basically so much for that month, which was so important, and it was amazing. But it just is, you connect with. So at that time, they were redoing the NICU in the Rotunda. So we were actually in basically this makeshift NICU that they had made in like an old hospital ward. So there was like a row of four babies. And obviously you're going in and you're sitting next to the same four women every day. And it just, the way it worked out, all of our babies, the ladies that I was in there with, had been born around the same time. And we all ended up leaving, like graduating from NICU around the same time as well. So it's so amazing. You really connect with them. And the nurses are just like, they're so amazing. I became friends with a couple of them. And then when I went in and had Noah, I met the same nurses and they were looking after him. And I chatted them on Instagram. And you learn so much from them as well. Like, in a way, I have such fond memories of that time in NICU because I learned so much. I really like enjoyed my time there in a weird way, even though when I look back now and I see the difference, having got to bring Noah home after a week, I feel like Milo was robbed of that early time, you know, when your baby's just home new and they're just sleeping on you the whole time. He really didn't have that. And I felt really guilty then when I saw what it should have been when you first have a baby. But I do look back on it with just really positive, fond memories. It's weird.
Yeah, it's like, even though something is so hard and so challenging, you know, through challenges we grow. And you didn't expect to be on this path, but you probably learned some amazing things along the way. Not that you would ever choose that path, but there you were and you just got on with it. And I think it's all about support and the people you have around you. And I have to agree that nurses in maternity hospitals are the best people on earth.
They're amazing. Yeah.
So you got Milo home, and what was that time like?
Yeah, so that was amazing to have him home and like start to try to get into a bit of a routine and have a bit of normality. But then I think it was 2 days after he came home, he'd woken up in the morning and Will was like, he's screaming, he's like crying, he's crying. And Milo never really cried as a baby, so I knew something was wrong, you know, when you just get that gut like mother instinct. So I stripped him completely naked and I could see that he had like a swelling on his abdomen. So I was like, we're going to Crumlin straight away, we're going to Crumlin. So we went over and it basically transpired that because when babies are born really early, sometimes their abdominal wall, the muscles haven't fully knitted together yet. So basically he had developed two hernias, which is just where the intestine is kind of like protruding through the abdominal muscles. So it's like his intestine is obviously just under the skin, the poor little thing. So we were admitted to Crumlin and he had to have surgery then 2 days later. So he was still only like 36 weeks, tiny little baby getting wheeled off on like the giant stretcher into surgery. And that was awful. That was, I think, the worst experience of the whole 2 months of him first being born. So he had the surgery, it all went really well. And we were in Crumlin for another few days. And that was such an eye opener because it really hit home with me how lucky we had been that he was born healthy, when you see all of the children in there and their families and what they're going through every day. But yeah, that was another just little hurdle in the road. And then we eventually kind of got home a week after that, and then it kind of settled and we got to just get into a bit of normality and routine and enjoy our baby.
God, you went through so much.
And that's the number one thing I say to, often I'll get mums message me and I'll get a message at like 2 a.m. It'll be like, hi, I just gave birth to my baby prematurely at 32 weeks. I really am totally overwhelmed. Do you have any tips? And the one thing I always say is, this is not going to last forever. Like, keep reminding yourself you're only living this right now. And in a couple of weeks, you'll be at home with your baby and it will all be a distant memory, because at that time, you feel like you're feels like baby jail, that you're never going to break out of there and get to bring your baby home. But it does all fly by really, really quickly in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, that's so reassuring for people to hear. So when it came to having Noah then, 2 years later, did you feel extra anxiety, or did you feel kind of that you'd been through this before, you'd gotten through it, if you have to, you'll do it again and everything will be okay?
So when I had Milo prematurely, basically they send off your placenta normally for assessment or to see if there's any, you know, infections or if they can find a reason basically why you went into labor early. And nothing came back. And when there's no reason found for spontaneous early labor, that means you're at an increased risk of it happening for your subsequent pregnancies, rather than if you had a weak cervix and they were able to figure out, you know, okay, that's why she went into labor, or you had an infection, or blah, blah, blah. So when there's no reason, you're at a higher risk. So I kind of knew in the back of my mind that I would probably have another early baby, but I also kept thinking it's not going to be that early. I knew I would get further along, and I was also on progesterone, which can help support the pregnancy and keep the baby in a little longer for Noah as well. So Noah, I got to, and it's so weird because I kept thinking for my whole pregnancy, I just want to get to 36 weeks. 36 weeks, the baby is basically fully cooked. Like, that's ideal for me, you know, won't be long in NICU, 36 weeks. And the day I turned 36 weeks, I felt my body like shift. It was almost like my brain was like, okay, you said 36 weeks, so here you go. So it was like the Saturday I turned 36 weeks and I felt myself start early labor. Like, I just could feel all the shifts in my body, and then got to Sunday and it was getting progressively. I could feel just something was happening. And then I woke up that morning on the Monday morning at about 3 a.m. and I was contracting, and I was kind of lying there in the bed thinking, okay, yeah, it's going to happen today. But I was totally calm. I was like, I want to get up and wash my hair before I go. Like, everything's ready. I just need to get organized. And I had a completely different mindset, because I had had such a positive birth with Milo, even though it was early. I just wasn't worried at all this time.
This time, right? You had Will. Tell us about that.
And basically, I let him sleep till 4. And then I woke him up and I was like, the baby's coming this morning, like, just so you know. And he was like, okay, well, will we get up and go? And I was like, no, you know what? I really want to just let Milo wake up. I don't want to disturb him. He normally wakes up around 7. So I was like, let's just lie here until 7. He was like, it's 4 in the morning. Like, do you want to just talk for 3 hours? And I was like, yeah, let's just, you know, let's just lie here, take a minute. So 7 a.m. came. I had text my mom or called her, I think at about 6:30. And I was like, this is it. You know, can you come down this morning for Milo? So at about 7, I went into him, like did his morning or whatever, and then had my shower, washed my hair. And by about 8, I was like, okay, let's go. So we went into the hospital. So we got into the hospital, met my consultant again, but this time I was having contractions they were coming every 5 minutes, but I hadn't actually dilated at all by the time I got to the hospital. So he was actually like, again, Will wasn't with me, but this time it was because of COVID rather than him not being there.
Oh my God, Jodie.
I know. So he was outside again, and Sam was like, I'm actually going to admit you and just keep you in for observation for a day or two, is what he said, to see if the baby came. And in my head, I was like, this baby's coming in a few hours. Like, I'm not staying here for a day or two. But I was like, okay, yeah, no problem. Like, let's get admitted. Went up to the room, and I remember getting admitted and being like, I can't stay here for 2 days on my own. Like, this is hell on earth and blah, blah, blah. I just knew like that wasn't what it was going to be. And within half an hour, my contractions then went to like every 2 minutes on the dot, and the pain went from like a 2 to a solid 7 or 8. So I remember calling the midwife and being like, please, can I have some pain relief, or like, can you examine me again and see what's going on? So she called my consultant back and he did another examination, and he was like, yeah, you're progressing. So what do you want to do? Are you happy to deliver now, or do you want to wait another while and see? And I was like, look, I'm happy to deliver now. Like, I'm delighted I got to 36 weeks. So then Will got to come in, and yeah, we had another really amazing section. I just loved it so much. I would do it 10 times if I could, honestly.
It's so good to hear. Like, I had a C-section as well, and it was a lovely experience for me too, but I was very scared of it. So now you have your two gorgeous boys. How long was Noah in NICU for in the end?
Noah had a couple of breathing difficulties, so he was in NICU for, I want to say, 4 days, I think, and then he got to come up to my room for the last night of me staying in the hospital. And then he came home with us on, I think, day 5. So much quicker than Milo. Total different experience. It was lovely.
Very reassuring for people who may have had one experience in their first pregnancy to know that not necessarily the same thing will happen in their second.
Exactly.
And Jodie, you've spoken about Spain and your love of Spain, and you guys spend a lot of time there, and you were kind of had said that you guys were thinking of maybe relocating. Is that something that you're still considering?
It's definitely something we want to do because as you said, we do spend a lot of time there. My parents have a place down there, so we go and avail of that free accommodation as much as we can. And I just, the more time I spend there, like, that's where I feel the most content in myself, and I'm happiest, and I think Will is the same. And I just think for raising kids to be in any kind of warmer climate would be amazing. But in the meantime, with Brexit, my husband is obviously English, and that means now he can't live there freely the way he could have before, or without a visa. So Will is transitioning to become an Irishman. And when happens, yeah, then I think we'll end up moving down. So I think it'll probably be another year or so, but hopefully, fingers crossed, we get down there for a while.
So you seem through kind of both of your births and, you know, things you've been saying on this podcast, that you really seem to trust your gut. And you were saying there that you feel very happy and content mm-hmm. in Spain. Like, how do you connect with yourself in that way? How did you learn to trust your gut?
I feel like it all kind of came from when I first got diagnosed with that brain condition, and I sort of felt that I needed to become more in tune with my own body and really kind of start to listen to what the little voice in your head is saying more. And that made a big difference for me because it meant I could kind of tune into myself and think, okay, I need to rest a little more this week, or I'm feeling like energized now is when I'm going to work. Because when you work in this industry, you know yourself, you don't switch off. There's no work hours. So I find that I'm available for the internet and for online 24/7. And I find that really hard to balance, because it's not that you just work a 9-to-5, you switch off at 5 o'clock and you have time for your family then. So that is something that I just struggle with massively. And for some reason, when I'm in Spain, I'm able to compartmentalize it a little bit better. I'm just happier there. I don't know how to describe it.
And when it comes to self-care, and obviously with two babies, it is hectic for mm-hmm. you. You obviously have such a brilliant relationship with Will. Can you tell him, look, I'm overwhelmed, I need some time out. Like, what do you do in that case?
Will and I are very different personality types, and I think that's why we probably balance each other out and complement each other. And he is very level-headed, and he's really, really positive person, really into positive mindset and wellness, and he's actually studying a course in that now. He just loves it so much, whereas I wouldn't really be into all of that kind of thing. Like, only in the last year I've gotten into, like, maybe like my positive affirmations or meditation, whereas I never, not that I didn't believe into it or buy into it before, it just wasn't on my radar. And he is polar opposite. So he kind of, whenever I'm spiraling and I'm totally overwhelmed, he grounds me and pulls me back down. And he's like, whatever you're stressed about, it's manageable. This is what's going to happen. You know, this is the plan. He sits down with me and does like a schedule for me, which I would never do. He's just Mr. Organized and Mr. Cool, Calm and Collected. So he helps me massively in that way. Yeah. And he's such a hands-on dad. Like, I would be lost without him.
And what are your kind of self-care techniques, like you said, like affirmations or meditation? And I do think that you have to arrive at that point when you're ready. Like, someone telling you to meditate, I don't think really works. I think you have to be like, okay, today I have arrived at the destination where I feel like I can welcome this into my life.
Exactly. And I feel like it's like when you're stressed and someone tells you, like, calm down or relax, you're like, are you? If someone tells you to calm down, it's the last thing you're going to do. So I do think you're totally right. It has to be when you're in the mindset for it. So having a routine is a massive one for me. So if I know, okay, I'm going to bring Noah out for his walk every morning, I'm going to put my podcast on and I'm going to have 40 minutes to myself. Because I find with two kids, what I struggle massively with is the chaos and the noise. It's just permanent, especially with two boys, noise from the minute they wake up to the minute they go to bed, that I need that quiet time for myself. So I have to remove myself from the situation, and I have to tell myself, you know what, it's okay to step away from your kids for half an hour. They're going to be fine when you come come back. You can't do it all.
And I think that's why people really connect with you and enjoy following you, is because you're very real. There is no bullshit. And is it important for you to kind of be real about family life?
100%, because I feel like there's so much pressure on Instagram as it is, you know, for to portray the perfect lifestyle. And I get it. Instagram is everybody's highlight reel and everyone is entitled to only show what they want to show. But I think as a mom, it's really important, if you can, if you're going to include your kids in your content, to show the good, the bad, the ugly, that not every day is, you know, rainbows and daisies. There are really hard days, and it's okay to acknowledge that and I guess normalize it in a way, so that one mum doesn't feel absolutely crap about herself if she's sitting in pajamas or a tracksuit she's been wearing for the last 3 days because she's had no time to shower and she's got baby puke on her shoulder, but she's wondering how the mum she's watching on Instagram has it all together, or so it appears, 24/7. I think that can be really detrimental when you're already in this crazy headspace of having a new baby or living with kids. And I just think it's important to show normal life and make it, you know, real, as real as you can.
And we spoke about Will and Jamie, and I'll just tell it from my point of view and then you could tell it from yours. But Will and Jamie met each other a couple of years ago in a meeting, and they've reconnected now and they're going on hikes together, right? So I'm like slagging Jamie a little bit, and I've been telling like my family, oh, Jamie's met a man on the internet and they're hiking together. But I was actually looking through Jamie's phone the other day to get a photo, because he takes a few photos for me now and again, and I was getting something and I found pictures of Will sitting on a rock up a mountain that Jamie had taken of him.
Because I was driving down the motorway with him the other day and he was like, look over in the distance there on the right, do you see that rock really far away? And I was like, no. And I was like, well, I'm driving at 100 miles an hour here, I can't look out the window to look at your rock. And he was like, I sat on that rock and Jamie took a picture of me there the other day.
Because I think they kind of have a similar...
They're very similar.
Yeah, no, it's really good. It's really good. Because I think like for Will as well, like you kind of forget, like he moved countries and, you know, he doesn't have his family here and his group of friends. Has he found that hard, or has he adjusted?
He hasn't seen his family now in well over a year with COVID and everything, which is really hard. And they haven't got to see Noah. And I know his parents are dying to see him. And obviously all of his best friends are in the UK, and we would have gone back several times a year, always, or always met up, you know, they would come here or whatever. So he would still be really close to his friends. He does have great friends in Ireland, but like you said, you know, his people are in the UK, so it's hard for him. But I guess the same as anyone, and no one has really seen their friends and family this year, so he's not alone in that boat.
So what is it that you would be most looking forward to when this is all over, when we get to get back to life as we once knew it? Like, do you have a picture of a moment or an experience that you're looking forward to?
Do you know what? I don't know if I've become institutionalized, but I'm pretty happy with our life right now. Like, I don't mind that we're in a little bubble, and yes, I would love to see more of our friends and our extended family. But at the same time, I've been so happy the last year that we've had so much quality time as a family. Like, whereas before I'd be waiting for Will to get home, you know, 6:30 on the dot every day. If it was 6:31, I'd be ringing and be like, where are you? Are you nearly home? And having him here the whole time has been so amazing, especially when you just have a newborn. Like, to have 6 months of Noah having Will here all the time, I've loved it. So in a way, I don't want to rush back to the old life that we lived pre-COVID. I'd like to take things from both. The slower pace of life, I'm 100% keeping. And then I am looking forward to just like more of a social life, definitely, and traveling again and that kind of thing. But this, I'm pretty happy with how we are right now.
Maybe one day the lads will invite us out on their hikes.
Yeah, and hopefully there'll be wine involved on that one.
Well, it was so good to catch up, Jodie. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast, with thanks to Spotlight Oral Care. If you enjoyed this episode, please do leave me a review. You can check out more about my story over on thegoodglow.ie or follow me on Instagram, georgie.crawford.